What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Melanie Netzer, the Senior U.S. Policy Director for the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, HIAS. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. In the early stages of this election year of 2012, it seems appropriate to muse a bit on just what it is that makes America unique. As Americans, we pride ourselves on many things. The size and beauty of our country, the power of our military, our scientific and technological innovation, the vigor and creativity of our popular culture, the dominance of our athletic teams, the extraordinary dynamism and popularity of our entertainment industry's creations. We used to brag about our robust economy, too, and maybe this will be the year we finally get to do that again. But above all, what has always set America apart to me has been the official ideals embodied in our formative documents and inscriptions, and recited and sung in all those patriotic hymns. We are officially the land of the free, the sweet land of liberty, lifting its lamp beside the golden door of equal opportunity and guaranteed rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is that official dedication to having a country in which anyone can rise to the level of his or her ability and drive that has made America a magnet for the talented and discriminated against people of the world, the place where individual ability and determined effort can build a good life in a land of opportunity, and most of all, of freedom, where success is solely dependent on talent and effort. None of that, of course, explains the success of the Kardashian sisters, who seem to lack both talent and ability, but, well, never mind. I digress. Anyway, the ideal of America has always been that it was the country where your rise or fall was dependent not on who you know, but what you know. Not which family or clan you belong to, but what your ideas and abilities achieved. Not on what religion you practice, but on what you contribute to society. Of course, a commitment to that ideal doesn't go untested and should never go unexamined. And throughout our history, we in the United States have often had a hard time living up to those principles, especially when the situation at hand involved people with minority backgrounds. Sometimes it was their country of origin that offended us as Native Americans and led to discrimination, deprivation of rights, even violence. No Irish allowed. Go back where you came from. Speak English only. Sometimes it was the religion of the person in question that offended us. Jews need not apply. No Catholics. No Muslim headwear allowed. No Mormons. Sometimes it was political difference that excited our anti-liberty passions. Better dead than red. Or websites showing gun sites on the districts of candidates who voted for health care. But most often in our history, it has been skin color that excited our bigotry and led us to break the promises made by our enlightened ideals. Our bias against Native Americans, our troubled history of anti-Latino prejudice, and most tellingly, our attitude towards the descendants of those brought to this country in chains, the black and brown-skinned African Americans. Here in the land of the free, where every vote counts, it was only in my own lifetime that African Americans could vote at all in many parts of our country. It was during my lifetime that Jim Crow was finally overturned, that the division of America into black and white worlds finally began to erode a bit. And it was only through the enormously determined work of great men and women that freedom for all became more than a slogan. This is the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Weekend, a fairly recent innovation in Arizona, but one that became a national holiday back in 1983, nearly 30 years ago. This King birthday is one of only 3 days on the American calendar honoring an individual. The others are Columbus Day and Washington's birthday, You know, as I remember growing up, Abraham Lincoln's birthday used to be a national holiday, or at least a school holiday, but apparently in the South, it never took hold for some reason or another. In any case, Reverend King represented a powerful vision of peaceful transformation of a corrupt system into a more ethical one. A vision that created a fundamental change in American life, helping move us, at least officially, from legalized racism towards justice. There were many Jewish supporters of King in his time, and there are many today who believe in his vision and seek to further his work. As U.S. Congressman John Lewis put it, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. understood that a special relationship exists between African Americans and American Jews. Both peoples were involuntarily uprooted from their homelands. Both peoples were shaped by the tragic experience of slavery. Both peoples were forced to live in ghettos, victims of segregation. Both peoples have been subjected to oppression and genocide on a level unprecedented in history. Dr. King understood how important it is not to stand by in the face of injustice. He understood the cry, "Let my people go." That cry, of course, originates in Exodus. It's central to this week's Torah portion of Vayera. And it's pretty cool synchronicity for this to fall on the King weekend. There's a famous photograph I talk about, taken of Dr. King marching arm-in-arm with a figure who looks just the way we would imagine a biblical prophet looking if that prophet was wearing an early 1960s business suit and narrow tie. The man with King is Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of the great theologians of the 20th century and a beautiful and profound author, teacher, and inspiration. His marching with King was typical of his moral focus, and it also symbolized a time when both peoples walked arm in arm. The King weekend is a very good time to remember that the general acceptance of civil rights as a colorblind truth in our society was very hard won and is a recent accomplishment. As Dr. King was inspired by the great message of liberation and radical equality that are at the heart of the Torah, so may we be similarly inspired to work to create a society truly based on those very principles, an American society in the best sense. Establishing a consistent tradition of social justice, even in a country that pioneered many documents and institutions of human liberty like we did, still takes constant effort. May we remain dedicated to that great effort, not only this weekend, but always. To play us in this morning, here's a classic hymn to America that reminds us of one aspect of who we are. Sephardic Jewish American poet Emma Lazarus' text for the base of the Statue of Liberty, set to music by Ashkenazic Jewish immigrant Irving Berlin, sung by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. What could be more American than that? That was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir singing Irving Berlin's setting for the Beyond Freedom and Immigration, penned by poet Emma Lazarus. Two thoughts here. Your religious background, whether you're Catholic like John F. Kennedy or Mormon like Mitt Romney or Jewish like Joe Lieberman, should in no way exclude you from running for the presidency, any more than your skin color should, like Barack Obama or... Well, okay, he's the only one yet, but still, the principle remains... Second, we need to remember that immigration is a central aspect of the American experience and very close to our hearts as both Americans and Jews. Our guest this morning, Melanie Netzer, works for one of the most venerable institutions in American Judaism, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, or HIAS. She'll explain why it's still vitally important when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. People sometimes ask me if I ever go to other restaurants and try their pizza. The answer is definitely yes. In fact, the other day I went to another restaurant to sample their pizza. So how did it compare to Mama's? Well, first of all, the crust tasted sweet. By that, I mean they added extra sugar to the dough. At Mama's, we don't add extra sugar to any of our food. The blend of fresh, natural ingredients we use makes our food taste, well, fresh and natural. Now, there's one more thing I noticed about the other pizza. Based on the portion size and price, I paid about 1.5 times more for it than one of ours. In this economy, that's a pretty big deal. So I guess one reason I try other restaurants is that it makes me realize Mama's Pizza is one of the best. And that's a very sweet feeling. Mama's Pizza with 4 convenient locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Melanie Netzer. She's a Senior Director for U.S. Policy and Advocacy for HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, a very famous institution in American Judaism. We'll talk about that in a couple of moments. Melanie Netzer directs HIAS's Washington, D.C. office, coordinates with their Immigration and Refugee Services Department. She's actively involved in education and advocacy on immigration, asylum, and refugee protection issues. She's the current chair of Refugee Council USA's Advocacy Committee. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So HIAS brings to mind a whole bunch of Jews landing at Ellis Island and being helped to their first apartment by HIAS. Is it still an organic, important part of the Jewish community? Tell us what HIAS does today.
Well, the answer to that is yes. And I think when a lot of people think of HIAS, they think of our initial activities. We're the oldest immigration and refugee organization in the country, not just Jewish organization serving refugees and immigrants. We started, obviously, welcoming Jews fleeing Europe in the late 1800s and throughout our history until about 20 years ago. We were exclusively focused on Jewish refugees because, as you know, the needs were so great throughout the last century. But we made a decision about 20 years ago, where although our core mission is still certainly to focus on rescue, reunion, and resettlement of Jews in need, and we still do that, and it's still our primary focus, our mission allows us to also serve other refugees and immigrants who can benefit from our 130 years of expertise.
How do you serve other refugees and immigrants? How do you determine which immigrant causes you adopt?
Well, we do that in a number of ways. In Washington, we are the HIAS advocacy office, so we advocate on immigration issues. We advocate for fair, just, and humane immigration reform. We were very active with the DREAM Act. We coordinate our advocacy, obviously, with local Jewish communities and try to make sure that the grassroots organizations in communities across the country that are advocating on immigration issues know what's going on in Washington and have the information that they need. We also do resettlement of refugees. We're one of the 10 national agencies that works with the State Department to receive refugees that are identified abroad and brought here for their safety and protection. And we, through Jewish agencies and others across the country, find them places to live and get them on their feet so they can start their new lives in the U.S.
We'll talk much more with Melanie Netzer of HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, about how immigration works, what HIAS does, and what the Jewish position is on all of this today when we come back on Two Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch Orkfel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us from 2JewishRadio.com or at the Apple iTunes Store as popular podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this great journey to Israel, email 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. You know, I mentioned social justice at the start of this show on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, and I also talked about President John F. Kennedy. Heard a great story at the recent URJ Biennial in Washington, D.C., commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Religious Action Center there, the principal social justice lobbying arm of the Reform Jewish movement. It seems that at the dedication of the original Religious Action Center building, called the RAC, President Kennedy was presented with a historic Torah scroll by its board. Arthur Goldberg was on the board, and he said, "Mr. President, we should also have given you a yarmulke." Without missing a beat, Kennedy said, "But Arthur, I'm a Reform Jew." True story. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov, good morning.
Israel has been engulfed to some degree in controversy about how being a Jewish state can be allied with being a democratic state. Is it the same thing? Are the two ideas completely opposed? You hear all manner of opinion on that. Where do you stand on that? What do you think people should do about kind of figuring that issue out?
You know, I think that's one of the main issues when one comes and asks himself, what does it mean to be Jewish? What is Jewishness? The Weintraub Israel Center will be hosting a program exactly on that subject on January 25th at 6:30 at the JCC called Faces of Israel. It's a program that combines a film with a dynamic discussion, and it will be presented by Amy Oppenheimer, the director of the film called Faces of Israel. In her film, Amy, an American Jewish young lady who came to Israel to study her first degree, is looking into exactly that question. What does it mean to be a Jewish and democratic state? And it doesn't always work together. For instance, in Israel, you see a lot of fluorescentic view. It's either you're a religious, a dati, or you're a secular, a chiloni. There are less flavors, if I might say. The ultra-Orthodox, the Haredim, are very strong in Israel and tend to be more extreme than the ultra-Orthodox that you meet here in the States. On the other hand, the secular in Israel are not what you call secular here, because most seculars in Israel fast on Yom Kippur, celebrate all the Jewish holidays. Many of them build a sukkah on Sukkot at the yard of their house. So you might say, hey, that's a religion activity. If you'll ask them, they'll say, no, it's our culture. We're Jewish because Jewishness is our culture. It's our nationality. It's our ethnicity. Most of them will not refer to the religion aspect as being a major aspect of their Jewishness. Although Hebrew will be...
Well, they all speak Hebrew anyway. They study Bible in school, Tanakh, because it's history. They consider it sort of historical.
And you can't even, you know, you're listening to modern songs, pop songs in Israel that are in Hebrew. Their words would have references to things that come from the Bible, from the Talmud. Well, I'm saying Bible, I probably should say Tanakh, because here there are different meanings,
right?
The
Hebrew Bible.
The Talmud, Zionist text from the beginning of Echad HaAm, of Jabotinsky, and many others. So, you know, that goes like a thread that makes Jewishness something, for me, much wider than only a question of faith. In many ways, and maybe what I'm saying might sound a little provocative, but the separation of faith from all the rest of those elements, from state, from nationality, was, you know, it was a brilliant marketing approach that came up with Christianity. The Christians were the first one to say, you know what, let's take only the faith and make a product out of it. Let's sell it to people as a product, you know?
And a marketing exploration of religion.
Yeah, and it was brilliant. Only for Jewish people, that doesn't work. We are one people. We're not only a religion. We're not only a nationality. We're all together.
It's fascinating. My grandfather wrote a book called Judaism, A Way of Life, and it really is about a people, a culture, a kind of a complex, organic whole. Very difficult to make that distinction. Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You recently went to the Museum of Tolerance, the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, and we were talking about its strength in its Holocaust exhibit, not necessarily totally up to date, but still a very good Holocaust exhibit, and the limitations of its tolerance exhibit. I have to say, I've never visited there when there weren't a number of school kids, large classes, African-American groups, Latino groups, police officers, firemen, going through and being sensitized to some of the important aspects of the Holocaust. That didn't necessarily make it an obvious link to tolerance, but maybe you can help us with that.
Well, this was a little bit of a disappointing aspect of the museum for me. I was with a friend who wanted to learn about the history of tolerance, and this is one of the primo museums of tolerance in the world by reputation. In fact, it's a very good Holocaust museum. And the connection between the Holocaust and the tolerance aspects of the museum is not so clear, and it's not so straightforward. And the museum was not nearly as strong on the tolerance half of its mission. I mean, clearly, the Holocaust itself is an extreme example of what happens when there's not only intolerance, but violence and a political agenda and a strong leader bent on the destruction of one or more minorities. Because, of course, Jews were not the only ones affected by the Holocaust, although Jews are often the first to forget that. Lots of other people were affected too. Gypsies, homosexuals, trade unionists,
political Catholics, organizers, leftists, communists,
handicapped
anybody,
people, all kinds of people.
Right.
And the question is, what's the best way to educate for tolerance? Is it to show what happens in one extreme case that many would argue is really one of a kind, when people get sent to gas chambers and exterminated en masse by the millions for belonging to one of these groups which are declared to be subhuman, undesirable, or just inhuman? I mean, sort of dehumanizing the other. And are there other ways in which we dehumanize the other and make it easier to attack them or bully them or enslave them or buy or sell them and kill them? And I think the answer is yes. And I think that education for tolerance might need to start in a less extreme place than the Holocaust. I mean, the Holocaust is almost unimaginable in its scope, in its scale, in its massive inhumanity. But how often do we hear, or even ourselves, use phrases like, "I got gypped," which is a slur against gypsies, or not us, obviously, because we're sensitive to this, but many other people who say, "I Jewed him down," or "they Jewed me down," and which is obviously a slight against Jews. And, you know, it's only really a few steps from that to dehumanizing the group involved, whatever it is, gypsies, gays, Jews, whatever. You hear kids always saying, like, "that's so gay," meaning just that they don't like something. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the sexual orientation of a pair of shoes, right? So, I mean, from this verbal behavior, it's only a few steps to treating Jews or gypsies or gays or whatever as if they're other with a capital O, and therefore disposable or blamable or attackable in some way. And I think that's an important subject we need to explore next time.
We will, and we, you know, couldn't be on a better subject on this Martin Luther King weekend. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The wife of a rabbi is approached by a sympathetic congregant who says, "being a rebbetzin, a rabbi's wife, is such a hard, demanding job. Ma'am, you really are a saint. There's a special place in heaven for rabbi's wives." To which the rabbi's wife replies, "Oh no, I'd rather be with my husband." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. This week we continue with the truly greatest story ever told, the Exodus narrative of slavery, plagues, and liberation. As this portion of Vaera begins, the Israelites are in Egyptian slavery. The mysterious figure of Moses has returned to try to free them from bondage. In Vaera, God brings about a series of plagues that traumatize the Egyptians and bedevil the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, boils, and cattle disease serially afflict the land and its inhabitants, or at least the non-Israelite inhabitants. In next week's portion of Bo, four more plagues will come. Hail, locusts, and darkness, all leading up to the climactic death scene of the slaying of the firstborn and the ultimate exodus, the great moment in which our ancestors are freed from slavery, the model for narratives of deliverance and emancipation ever since. These plagues are interesting in and of themselves. There are three sets of three plagues each, increasing in severity and complexity, every one designed to prove the power of the true God and the impotence of the pagan gods of Egypt. The Nile River was the principal deity of Egypt, as well as the source of its life and livelihood, and so, for the first plague, God simply turns it to blood. There are frog gods in the Egyptian pantheon, and they are next turned into pests that infest homes and fields. The scarab is a sacred beetle to Egyptians, a symbol of Pharaoh's power, and these very insects are then used to torment the inhabitants. And so it goes. Sacred cows get diseases. The fertility of the land of Egypt itself is destroyed. Finally, even the great Ra, the solar disk of the sun itself, is blotted out for days. The plagues are a statement of theology. There is only one God. Those who adhere to other gods and use their own power to enslave others will be overthrown with power and majesty. The arrogant will be overcome. Freedom will be guaranteed, and justice through the true God will triumph. It's a message that still has great resonance today. Whenever we come to believe that evil is destined to reign, that those who enslave others will rule always, and that those who use their control for malign purposes are destined to flourish, we should reread this plagues narrative here in Exodus. For at heart, this is a universe created by God for good. When we increase justice, we are simply doing the work for which we were made. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Melanie Netzer, will explain just why the immigration issues confronting us today are profoundly Jewish in nature, even when they don't always involve Jews. Find out how that is when we return in a few moments here on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K through 12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Just one special tribute today. Frisch besetzt im gedeckten Tisch und mit der lang gefüllten Fisch.
gefilte Fisch, gefilte, gefilte Fisch, gefilte, gefilte Fisch, gefilte. Oi. Gefilte.
Adrienne Cooper, an American-born singer, teacher, and curator of Yiddish music, who was a pioneer in the effort to keep Yiddish alive for new generations, and a former guest of Too Jewish, died on December 25th in Manhattan. She was 65 years old. The cause was adrenal cancer. Though the movement she helped start in the 70s and 80s was often described as a Yiddish revival, less sentimental observers acknowledge that a true revival of the spoken language among secular Jews was unlikely because people who learned it in their homes, Holocaust survivors, children of turn-of-the-century Jewish immigrants, were dying out. But because of the great teaching and tremendous organizational work of Adrienne Cooper and a few others, klezmer has now become a popular current of music in the mainstream, and Yiddish courses are given at many, many colleges. Her friend Alicia Svigals, the great klezmer violinist, said, Adrienne Cooper was the mother of the revival. Cooper, blessed with a lush, expressive mezzo voice and a crusader's fervor, shepherded dozens of young performers into Yiddish music and its wonderful culture. She taught Yiddish songs, obscure ones she unearthed, and brand new ones, not just beloved chestnuts like Rejin Gizmit Mandlin, to students in a Yiddish program given at Columbia University by the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research, and in programs that Cooper arranged through her most recent position as a cultural executive of the Arbeiterring, the Workman's Circle, the Jewish social welfare organization. Cooper's interpretations were enriched by the context she brought as a one-time history student. Her performance has a depth and emotional fire that make it clear she understands where these songs come from, said Samuel Norich, publisher of The Forward, the great Jewish newspaper. With Henry Sapoznik, a former guest of Too Jewish and a former winner of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award, Adrienne Cooper was one of the two founders of KlezCamp. Since 1985, it has convened annually in late December in the Catskills, an incubator of klezmer musicians like clarinetist Michael Winograd and the Floating Academy of Yiddish Culture. KlezCamp has drawn hundreds of musicians, connoisseurs of Yiddish language, and amateur anthropologists eager to delve into the extinguished Jewish cultures of Eastern Europe, or nearly so. Adrienne Cooper, who called the gathering a flying shtetl, I love that term, sounds so much like a Chagall painting. Adrienne Cooper taught there and was the associate director of YIVO in the early 80s when she turned a notion brought to her by an archivist of hillbilly music into reality, persuading officials like Norich, then YIVO's executive director, to finance it. News of Adrienne Cooper's death came just as KlezCamp was gathering in New York. Henry Sapoznik, the Ukrainian cantor's son and archivist, the other founder, as I mentioned, said that the news cast a pall over KlezCamp, but at the same time, people realize her contributions are really present. On the liner notes of her last album, Enchanted, Cooper wrote that she and her friends embraced Yiddish for its hard-to-describe delights, for the rage it brings to injustice, for its wonderful weight on the tongue, for the arc it forms between poles of Jewish identity, from otherworldly to this-worldly, from grit to grace, and for the astonishing ushpizin, the unexpected guests who show up and have what to say.
I wish I were what you desire.
I wish you were what you desire.
I wish I were what you desire.
I wish I were what you desire.
And if I only wish what you desire, I would give you all that you require.
Lullaby, 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 lullaby.
I wish I were a bumblebee.
Bumblebee.
Lullaby, I wish I were a bumblebee. And if I really were a bumblebee,
those three labels, three labels.
Oh, my honey, I would get to the lullaby, lullaby, lullaby.
The yumbaby, the yumbaby, the yumbaby, the yumbaby, the yumbaby.
Adrienne Cooper's voice may now be stilled, but her wonderful Yiddish legacy lives on. Gay gesunter heit. And that's the news of Jews around the world.
Our brothers,
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Melanie Netzer. She directs the Washington Office for Hias, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. She's a senior director for U.S. Policy and Advocacy for Hias. She's very involved in education and advocacy on immigration, asylum, refugee protection, both here and internationally. In her previous role at Hias, she was the Migration Policy Council, which is a great title, by the way.
Was it hard
to give that one out? That sounds so powerful.
Well, it was very difficult to give that one up.
So tell me, what sort of work does Hias do internationally?
Well, our international programs are pretty varied. Let's start in our hemisphere. In South America, we actually provide trauma counseling to Colombian refugees who have fled to Ecuador, Panama, and Venezuela. We also help resettle Colombian refugees in Argentina. We're the partner of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, and we help that effort, helping Colombians start new lives in Argentina. We also we help refugees in Africa. We have offices in Kenya, Uganda, and Chad. We provide trauma counseling and other kinds of refugee services in Africa. One of our really interesting programs is we are in Israel. Our Israel office works with the government of Israel to establish a new asylum system to deal with the African refugees that are coming in over the border. This is a relatively new phenomenon for Israel. And
coming in through the Egyptian border now that it's sort of more open, right?
That's
right. Since the fall of Mubarak.
Right, African refugees, primarily from Sudan, from South Sudan, Eritrea, and other countries. And then a key program for us is a program that we run in conjunction with the State Department in Vienna, where we process Iranian religious minorities, including Jews, Christians, and Baha'is, who need to leave, who need a safe way to get out. And with the U.S. government's assistance, we help process them in Vienna, where they go through all the screenings and then come to the U.S. for refugee resettlement. So that's a very critical program that we run. So we have programs all around the world doing different kinds of services based on our 130 years of expertise with refugees and migration, and we're really making an impact.
When you work with Israel, Israel has more experience bringing in immigrants than any country in the world, but they were Jewish immigrants, at least, you know, that's the theory. And absorbed far more than its total population over the course of 40, 50 years. How do the Israelis respond to this new challenge? Because these are now immigrants who are not, okay, just Jews from Morocco or Yemen or the former Soviet Union or Ethiopia, but people who aren't Jewish from a different background. What's the response of the Israeli society and Israeli government?
Well, it's very complicated, as you might imagine. The situation in Israel is very different than it is here, where, you know, our experience of immigration in this country we're not defined by any one religion or faith or culture. In Israel, it's much more of a kind of a balancing between what Israel wants to be and its profound understanding and obligation to refugees. Israel was the first country that signed the UN Refugee Convention. The reason we have a United Nations Refugee Convention, which was adopted in 1951, was because of the experience of the Jews in the Holocaust. So Israel really, I think, to its core, understands the need to protect refugees. At the same time, this is a new phenomenon with security implications, so it's a very delicate situation. I will recommend for people who are listening the Oscar-winning short documentary from last year, Strangers No More, which is about an Israeli school that educates Jewish, Muslim, and Christian, and really kids from all faiths in Tel Aviv. It's a fantastic look at really the changing nature of immigration to Israel and how some Israelis are responding to that.
When you, I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit here. Immigration has always been controversial in America, even though we're all immigrants. I mean, even the Native Americans came across a land bridge from Asia. So really, we really should have that consciousness built into our souls. But we don't many times. And there's an anti-immigrant sentiment that rises at various times, particularly in challenging economic times. How does Hias deal with that? Do you deal with it?
Well, I mean, I think it's something obviously the country is grappling with. And we feel as Jews, we have a biblical mandate to welcome the stranger. You're the rabbi, not me. So maybe you could talk more about that. But we also historically in this country have benefited greatly from immigration. This country has been really good to us because it has opened its doors to Jews. And we think that our experience, as a people of migration, should lead us to be more understanding about the reasons that people leave their countries and the contributions that they make when they get here. So we feel very strongly that our country's immigration laws are outdated. They haven't been seriously updated since 1965. The world has changed dramatically. We feel very strongly that immigrants contribute to the economic health of this country, that not knowing what immigrants are in this country is a security issue, that we should have a system where people are able to prove their legal status or obtain legal status and become permanent parts of our society. So we think, again, from the religious perspective and also from our own historical perspective, we must welcome immigrants.
Obviously, I agree with you. I mean, we've been wandering Jews for a very long time. You know, Jews have been immigrants since the time of Abraham. It repeats again and again the injunction not only to welcome the stranger, but to love the stranger. So it's certainly a strong Jewish concept. How did Jews support Hias? I mean, you know, it was originally a Jewish organization. Has its transformation to, notwithstanding the work being done in Israel, supporting primarily immigrants from many other parts of the world, how has that affected the Jewish community's relationship with Hias, and what does that mean?
Well, I think first just to point out that our critical core mission is to really make sure that if Jews need to leave the country that they're in, we are able to assist them. And because of our strong relationship with the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security and the work that we're doing kind of in the broader immigration and refugee arena, we are able to really be there when crises do emerge. So, for instance, with the Jews in Iran, we have been able to work with the State Department to ensure that if a Jew in Iran needs to leave and wants to leave, there's safe passage out. And that's not true for refugees from all countries. This is an arrangement that we have for the Jews, Christians, Baha'is, and several other persecuted faiths in Iran so that we can ensure that they can leave safely. Now, that's something that the Jewish community worked very hard to ensure. We wanted to make sure that there was a way that if Jews needed to leave Iran, they could leave safely. So a lot of the work that we do, I mean, we do it because we want to help people, but we also do it because we want to make sure that when there's a crisis in our own community, our government responds and we're able to lobby for that. And just another example, when the Argentine economy collapsed back in 2001, we set up a program right away. Basically, what happened in that country was that half of the middle class became poor almost overnight. And it has as you know, Argentina has the fourth largest Jewish population in the world, most of whom were middle class or doing, you know, basically doing very well in Argentina. And overnight, they lost most of what they had.
Right.
So we stepped in very quickly. We had an office in Argentina. We hired somebody to find jobs for Jews in Argentina who could qualify for religious visas or for work visas to come here. And many of them came. We helped them get the visas pro bono. And many of them have since gone back, but they were able to maintain their families during that time of crisis in that country. So, you know, we also keep very close tabs on what's going on with Jews in Venezuela. So that really, you know, is our primary mission. At the same time, we realize that, again, given our history and given our expertise and given the fact that, you know, we're always going to need the support of other communities when we need help ourselves, we think that the work we do for others on a non-sectarian basis is just as important.
You alluded to this earlier, but it seemed to me that the immigration system, you hear it often, is broken. You're here in Southern Arizona with us. As you know, we experience a pretty steady flood tide of immigrants on a regular basis, many of whom don't intend to stay permanently but want to come and work and go back home. Our system doesn't work very well, and every attempt to reform immigration in the last 40 years has run aground somewhere along the way. What's Hias's position on immigration reform? Does Hias get involved in those kinds of discussions?
We do, but first I want to point out there was an article just yesterday, I believe, in the Washington Post that noted that the number of immigrants coming over the border illegally from Mexico is now at a level that has not been at since the 1970s. It has dropped significantly in recent years, and it's in direct correlation with primarily the recession, but also increased enforcement efforts along the border. So at some point, I think Again, there are many reasons why we can say the system is broken. The fact that there are so many undocumented immigrants in this country, I think, shows you that the system is broken. We have a lot of people underground. They don't get any benefits. So they're not coming here for any kind of public benefits. The only reason they come is to work. So why not have a system that facilitates that and keeps people on the books and not living in fear? So we do get involved in immigration advocacy. We work very closely with communities across the country, Jewish communities that want to engage in immigration reform. Most of the work that we do also is interfaith, both on the national level and in local communities. So we build very strong ties also with the Latino community on the basis of our shared interest in a humane immigration system that actually works and serves our country's interests. So we feel very strongly about that.
What can faith communities, synagogues, Jewish communities, and other faith communities do to assist in improving the situation of immigrants in the United States?
Well, I think the first thing is just not to give up. I think there are a lot of communities across the country that have been working on this. Lots of synagogues have been engaged. Lots of local organizations have been engaged. But, you know, you get tired because you don't see change.
Right.
And, you know, through the We Were Strangers 2 campaign, which you can actually, you know, look it up online. You can go through our website, or I think you can actually just access it through WWS2.org. I'm not sure. You might have to come through HIAS first.
And HIAS is HIAS.org. HIAS.org.
And get information about materials. We work in coalition with our partners around the country in Jewish communities. There are many materials to link to religious observances, Sukkot, Passover, Purim, materials. So there's ways that you can engage your community. There's also, we have a really great program where it's about a 2-hour program called Welcoming the Stranger. And it's a DVD program, interactive program, which is a fun thing to do with your, you know, at a Hillel or at your synagogue. There are different ways to really connect with the current issue of immigration, connect it to where we were and where we came from, and give ideas of how you can engage on that issue today.
So, you know, as a people who all were migrants at one point, in the Torah portions we read in Exodus, we left. And so we know a little bit about this. I want to thank Melanie Netzer for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The organization is HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, HIAS.org.
HIAS.
I'm sorry. Just testing. HIAS.org, HIAS.org. Thank you so much, Melanie.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll get a final musical play out and hear about next week's guest.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. where our guest will be Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, the founder and president of the cutting-edge Israel advocacy organization, the Israel Project, and by the reckoning of the Forward newspaper, the second most influential Jew in the world last year. Imagine that. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or on our TooJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from the group Eighth Day, a fun tune called Yalili. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Yala, yala, yalili. Yala, yala, yalili. Yala, yala, yalili. Yala, yala, yalili. Oh, yala, yala, yalili. Yala, yala, yalili. Yala, yala, yalili. Tans, 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 habi.
Ashkenazi, Rabbi Nachman, Ashkenazi, Shetehele Mazal, Osevadi, Metshavadi, Ashkenazi.
Yala, yala, yalili,
Shit,